America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And we need to make it a great day in the midst of this unusual season. It is a holiday season. I know today is actually the first day of Passover, so I'm recording this in advance in order to observe the holiday. But I'm doing so because I have the opportunity to speak to a truly remarkable American. And if there's anyone who I think can help to put what we're all going through into perspective, it's David French. David is a principal at thedispatch.com, where he holds court. You know him from his work at National Review. You know him for his work as a major in the United States military with service in Iraq. And in fact, his most recent column is about that. And David, I know you've written about your military experience before, but one of the things that has always impressed me about your work is you look back on that time of your life and you draw out the good, what came positively about your experience in war. Do you think it's possible and, in fact, necessary to try to do the same about what everybody is going through in this COVID-19 pandemic situation?
Yeah, you know, I drew back on my experience in wartime because that was an almost year-long period of life where you live day to day and you literally just don't know if everything is going to be okay. You know, there's this sort of assurance that parents give kids when kids are younger. You know, everything's fine, you'll get better, everything's fine. But I think at some point in life, each one of us goes through a period of time where we don't know that that's the case. And for a lot of people, it's, say, you know, your soldiers deployed overseas. Or for other people, it might be they get an unbelievably terrifying health scare, or they are caught in the middle of a natural disaster, as some of my neighbors were here in Middle Tennessee just a little over a month ago. And you just don't know if everything's going to be okay. And people learn to live in that circumstance. And that's what I did for a year in Iraq, almost a year in Iraq. And I just was reflecting on that as, you know, I was talking to my own kids about a crisis where we don't know how everything's going to work out here. And we don't know if everything's going to be okay. And there were just some lessons I learned during my time in that circumstance that I just thought, you know, that helped me get through and helped me find purpose in that experience. And I just wanted to pass some of those things along.
We're speaking with David French. His piece in The Dispatch, Walking Through the Valley of the Shadow of Death, is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. And David, I think that for people who know the 23rd Psalm, which you reference obviously in the title of your piece, the next words are very important. The next words being?
I don't have them right in front of me. So.
I'll tell you what they are, because it's very important. It's, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil.
For thou art with me.
Well, that's it. And yes. Again, you apply that in your column, both to your service in Iraq and to the current situation. Explain.
Yeah, so I basically came up with four things, and I didn't put them in order of importance, but the four things that really helped me on a day-to-day basis, and they were pretty simple. It was one, find your band of brothers. In other words, it is so much more difficult to go through a crisis alone than it is to go through a crisis with a band of brothers or sisters. And in that circumstance, I've been doubly blessed. I mean, on the one hand, in Iraq, I served with some of the finest men you'll ever meet, and we had a bond tighter than brotherhood. And now I'm in my shelter in place with six folks in our house who are my family, and we're very, you know, we have a wonderful family and very blessed that we don't have a fractured family. But even those people who are more alone need to intentionally reach out and try to create a community, even if it's just virtual, where you walk through this together. The other thing is find a purpose. And your purpose just can't be sort of sitting down and watching Netflix and just enduring day to day. I talked about how my wife has just been heroic in this circumstance, not only sort of keeping my older extended family members well supplied and cooking for them and making sure they have everything they need. She's also reached out to people hundreds of miles away who are shut in and alone and made sure that they didn't feel alone, and also to help try to supply them with the supplies that they needed. And then the other thing is seek joy. Try to find and intentionally create opportunities to just experience laughter and happiness. I mean, when I was in Iraq, and now you don't have to tell a group of 20-something guys or 30-something guys to seek fun. It just kind of happens naturally. But even in the darkest of circumstances, we found opportunities to quite simply laugh and have a good time. And then the last thing I said is have faith. That's where you get to the 23rd Psalm, that thou art with me. And it doesn't mean, and that doesn't mean that if thou art with me, that everything's going to be okay. It's that no matter what happens, God is with you. And I think there's this sort of simplistic faith that says, well, if God is with me, no harm will come to me. We all know that's simply not the case. And, going into the Beatitudes in the New Testament, which says, Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. What does that imply? It implies that there will be sometimes cause to mourn, even when God is with you. But God is always with you. And that keen awareness of his presence and his sovereignty over my life was of incalculable comfort during that time.
And again, part of what you're talking about is mixing the sacred and the secular, mixing joy with realism. I was struck by your piece. You're talking about finding joy at the front in Iraq, where so many Americans have basically just forgotten about this. You can obviously never forget. But what struck me is you guys found joy not only playing Rock Band on video games, but playing World of Warcraft. It's kind of not what you'd think you'd be wanting to do on the front, right?
Well, you know, one of the things you'll find, and I'm sure you encountered this in all the soldiers you've talked to, is that soldiers are unbelievably creative and inventive in improving their own living conditions no matter where they are. And one of the things that we were able to do was we were able to obtain an old Iraqi satellite dish from the Iraqi army of the 1980s. I mean, this thing was rusted old bucket. Used the expertise of our signals officer to point it at a Hughes commercial satellite. Was able to use a phone to contact Hughes and set up a custom satellite internet plan for us that allowed us to get online and talk to, you know, our friends and our families, and also to connect to the internet and play World of Warcraft. So that's how creative and inventive you can turn a 1984 Iraqi Army satellite dish into streaming video games. So that's one of the things that you'll see around soldiers, no matter where they are, is they figure out a way to make their life better. And that's one of the things, one of the lessons of this is we need to figure out ways to make our lives better, even in the face of dreadful uncertainty and fear.
That is so profound, and it is so important. I know that a lot of people, and it's certainly true for my wife and myself, and it sounds trivial, but it's an amazing thing, and I think it has a great deal of force, is just walking around the neighborhood. In other words,
yes.
Rab, because we're all at home right now, and there was a piece which I covered on the air a couple of days ago in the New York Times of new studies that show that actually walking, taking 4,000 steps a day or more, is the most beneficial exercise you can possibly do. And one of the things that it also means that you see your neighbors. They're not,
yes.
I mean, from a 6 feet distance, of course, but yes. You see your neighbors, and it's a very different feeling. Is that happening in your neighborhood in Tennessee?
Well, I have a very walkable neighborhood. The houses are kind of close together, but it's very easy to walk and social distance. And you just see an enormous amount of neighborhood spirit that is, and it's always been a very neighborly place, but it's sort of neighborly on steroids now. And we're just talking to my family about how blessed we are to shelter in place in circumstances where we can get outside responsibly. And it made me really feel for those folks who are in some of these high-rise apartment buildings where you're thinking, okay, I've got to plan out my departure from this high-rise building where thousands of other people are living and using elevators, et cetera, et cetera. And it just made me feel a lot of compassion for the different circumstances that other people are in. We're extremely blessed to be able to shelter in place in a place where we can get out and we can walk and we can run. And there's opportunity to interact safely with neighbors. And yeah, I have seen an enormous amount in those circumstances of real, truly neighborly behavior and a sense of community, fellowship, and bond that I hadn't seen as much before.
We're speaking to David French of thedispatch.com. And he does a newsletter at The Dispatch called The French Press. Get it? And his column in from the French Press at thedispatch.com is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. People can go check it out. And people know David French not only for your personal narratives, which are deeply moving, about faith and about politics and about family and all the crucial issues that we live with, but you also have talked about your experience in the war and the lessons from the Iraq war that are appropriate for leadership. And right now, I mean, President Trump has said he is a war president. What do you take away that could be useful for leaders around the world right now about what's essential to be an effective war leader?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there are a few things. One is stability, steadiness. In other words, while other people may be rocked by emotions and they may be troubled and they may be staggered by the times, you're not. So there's got to be a projection of stability. There has to be a projection of not just competence, but excellence. You know what you are talking about. So there's steadiness in times of trouble. There's a commitment to excellence. That means being a sponge of information and producing information that is useful for people, that they can count on, that they can rely on. And then in the military context, there is the necessity of courage of leading by example. Now, that's less, in many ways, that's harder to do when you're talking about a pandemic. I mean, how do you show courage in the face of a virus? But it can also mean leading by example and demonstrating to others the kinds of behaviors you would like to see them use in their own lives. And so these are the key elements. It's that courage, commitment to excellence, stability. All of those things have been hallmarks of some of our best leaders in our times of worst crises. And if you look across the United States, one of the interesting things about this is, you know, all eyes are on Donald Trump, but that's wrong. This is one of the most federalist crises that we have ever encountered in our lives, because the fact of the matter is that while Donald Trump has enormous resources at his disposal, when it comes to the actual orders that govern our lives during this time, that's a matter of mainly governors and mayors. And so it's putting a premium on local leadership, unlike we've seen really in my adult lifetime. And so we're sitting here and we're not only evaluating our national leaders, we're also evaluating our state leaders to see if they demonstrate those qualities.
No, that's entirely true. It's one of those things. Let me just ask you, I know this is risky, but are there any state leaders, for instance, who have particularly impressed you? The reason I wanted to mention it is because Gina Raimondo, who is the governor of Rhode Island, who is known to be kind of a shockingly moderate Democrat.
Right.
She is not a progressive, thank goodness. And boy, she has been tough and effective. And if you watch her, it's a tiny little state, But she's the one who said, hey, we don't want New Yorkers asking people, given the fact that New York is such a center of the virus, asking the state troopers to question people who drive over state lines with New York license plates. And again, she has impressed me by being sort of tough and exceptional and absolutely on top of things. Anybody in your book?
Yeah, this is a really interesting and good question, because competence is not necessarily connected all that much to ideology. And we have overvalued ideology and undervalued competence until a crisis rolls around. So there's some people who've really stood out. If you look at Ohio's response, Governor DeWine, where he jumped on things earlier than a lot of other people. If you just look at the raw numbers in his state compared to some of the neighboring states in the Midwest, there has been a very positive outcome for his state. Gavin Newsom, who's as progressive as they come, you know, a lot of people are praising Andrew Cuomo for his steadiness in these daily briefings and his, you know, the competence he's been displaying. But don't sleep on Gavin Newsom, because if you look at the actual numbers, California, which contains a number of quite dense cities, cities that have more than average contact with China than many other American cities, and the rate of infection, the slower spread has kind of spoken for itself. And so you can look around the country and you'll see that frequently competence is independent of ideology, and we have to be able to recognize results and recognize competence independently of whether we would like that, we'd like some of the public policies of the leader in question. And I do think that this is going to be an interesting political effect here, to the extent to which in our hyper-polarized nation is one way through the polarization to put a premium on competence over ideology, or will we go right back to our old ways as soon as this crisis eases? And if you look at Twitter, I'm not optimistic about that. But
well,
thankfully, most people are not on Twitter.
Again, looking at Twitter, where, by the way, David French has a gazillion followers and is very, very prominent. But looking at Twitter can be disquieting, even under the best of circumstances. Speaking of the best of circumstances, let me conclude with this. There seems to be a consensus, and again, this goes beyond ideology, that we're going to be different after this, that things are going to change. And not all of it is going to be for the worse. Some of it will. If you can think of two things that you think are likely to change in America, one for the worse and one for the better, what would you point out?
Well, the one I've been thinking about, and I don't know if this categorizes, if I can cheat a little bit, said I don't think it's for the worse or for the better. It just might be different. And that is, we have been racing towards urbanization, more dense living. And I do wonder if this lasts for a longer time than we hope, if that will begin to create increased appreciation for space, for distance in living. And so I do wonder if that might slow some of this relentless urbanization. And you know, I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think it could be quite significant. Let me then say one thing for the better: an increased understanding of federalism.
That's very important.
I think that an increased appreciation of local control. It used to be that we had a saying that all politics was local, but as we got more polarized, the reverse was true, that all politics is national. However, that can be good or bad. And if we have sort of this sense that what happened because the virus has so far afflicted the cities more than the countryside, that there is a blue-red divide in suffering, a blue-red divide in response, then increased emphasis on federalism could lead to greater division and greater polarization.
But the point is, it also leads inevitably to greater constitutionalism, one hopes. David French, thank you for your service to our country, both in wartime and in this time of pandemic. His column is posted at michaelmedved.com. We will be right back. And on the Michael Medved Show, it is a tremendous pleasure for me to have a chance to speak to one of the foremost American historians, truly. Somebody who's won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes, a National Book Award, who has had a whole spate of number one bestsellers. Joe Ellis, Joseph J. Ellis, is the author of Founding Brothers, An American Sphinx, and many other fine books. And there's a new book that's coming out in paperback, and you can get it now, which is just terrific and eye-opening, as only Joe Ellis could make it. It's called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. And he takes a look at the ideas, the vital, I mean, electrifying ideas, and they still are, of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and the way that those ideas, and George Washington, by the way those ideas apply to contemporary debates, which where those ideas are often misused. Joe, congratulations on American Dialogue, and we've posted the book up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Let me ask you first,
Michael, it's great to be with you. What you're not telling people is we know each other from way back. And Michael was a student at Yale when I was a graduate student, and I got to teach him in one course. So this is a long friendship.
It is, and it was that was the most single memorable course of my entire educational experience, because it was colonial history taught by the unbelievably great, your mentor, Professor Edmund S. Morgan.
Yeah.
And again, it's just so terrific to see you were the teaching assistant in my section, which was lucky for me. And again, that's a consuming love for colonial history that has obviously dominated your life and changed mine. So let me go right to the founders and to some of the controversies in American dialogue. Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about the Constitution and what it means, nowhere is that more controversial than the Second Amendment, when people are talking about how this applies.
It's much more controversial now than it was then, yes.
Right. I mean, then, of course, people assumed, well, first of all, what about this notion that the Second Amendment means that you simply cannot restrict firearm ownership at all? What would James Madison have thought of that?
He would have been bewildered. I mean, of course, you can't, you know, they're busy being dead. You know, they can't come and talk to us about this. We can go back to their papers, and that's what I do. But that there was a decision made in 2008, the majority opinion by Antonin Scalia, the leading originalist on the court then. He's gone to the hereafter. Which did conclude that the Second Amendment provided a virtually unlimited right to own and carry a gun. And that decision overturned two centuries of federal and Supreme Court precedents. And at least as I read the evidence, is not what Madison intended when he wrote it. It's not what the members of the House or Senate meant when they passed it. It's not when the 11 states that ratified it meant when they did that. And
so what did Madison mean when he said that shall not infringe?
First of all, the 10 amendments were not called the Bill of Rights then. The person who gave him that title is, believe it or not, Franklin Roosevelt in 1939 and 40. He was the first person to talk about the Bill of Rights. He was using it as a term to talk about the values we were going to fight World War II about. And but that Madison wrote the Bill of Rights, what we call the Bill of Rights, in the spring of 1789 in order to appease those states that had ratified the Constitution quite reluctantly and had submitted recommended amendments that would be considered after the Constitution was in place, and appease them. And six of the states had been very concerned about the creation of what they called a standing army. A standing army was in the tradition of the British Army or even the Continental Army, a danger to all republics, and they were worried that the Constitution would permit that. The Second Amendment was designed to relieve them of that worry by making the case that national defense would not be in the hands of a professional army, but in the hands of state militia, and that was the term bear arms. The right to bear arms didn't mean the right to own and carry a gun. It meant the right to serve in the militia, or if you do a digital search of the 10 most prominent founders, and you can do this easily, there's about 257 occasions when the term bear arms is used. All of them mean serve in the military, either the militia or the Continental Army. So that the decision that Scalia made was a reversal and overturning of the principle of stare decisis. It was a 5-4 decision, and in my judgment, it was a kind of Alice in Wonderland travel through some labyrinth to try to come to that conclusion.
Okay, but
it was almost like
let's back up a little bit, because beyond the Heller case, even the Heller decision, as I remember it, by Justice Scalia, Justice Scalia doesn't argue that the purpose of the Second Amendment was to have an armed populace to protect itself against its own government, does he?
No. He argues that it's an amendment designed to allow people
to defend themselves.
To defend themselves in this particular case, it was a Washington D.C. Case from somebody was coming into your house and
right. So, but they're not anticipating that you're going to use the Second Amendment as a license to kill cops if they come into your house or to kill soldiers if they're
No. There are quotations that the National Rifle Association developed as part of its own brochures over the years that implied that if you didn't have this right, that the government was going to come and take your guns away. And they quote Patrick Henry allegedly to say in the Virginia Ratifying Convention for the Constitution, they're going to take away your guns. And he didn't say that. What he said is they're going to take away, and then the N-word, and to gales of laughter, apparently. And there was never a time in the Revolutionary War when the British Army came house to house to take people's guns away. They did go to arsenals to capture ammunition and stuff.
The
implementation of the true meaning of the Second Amendment occurred in the Militia Act of 1792, right after it was ratified. It was the Militia Act said that every able-bodied man between the ages of 19 or 18 and 49 must purchase a musket and an outfit, meaning a gun belt and boots, so that the real meaning of the Second Amendment is not that you have a right to own a gun, but that you have an obligation to serve.
And by the way, what's fascinating about this is that two of the countries that are famous for having almost universal military service in Switzerland and Israel, they have the same idea, which is, yes, you have a right to have a gun if you've served in the military. But for other people, it's far more restricted. We are just about out of time, Joe. The book is called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. There's so much more here about economic policy, about the power of government, about limitations on government, and limitations on liberty and the view of the founders and how it's so highly relevant today. You will find it fascinating. It's important. It's posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's just coming out in paperback, American Dialogue, The Founders and Us, by the great former teacher of mine, Joseph J. Ellis. We will be right back on The Medved Show. It's a great pleasure to be sitting down with two gentlemen who have created a product that I use and count on and trust and actually give to friends. A product's called Relief Factor, and it actually does help with all kinds of aches and pains that people develop from time to time, back pain, leg pain. Seth and Pete First of all, congratulations on the phenomenal success of a phenomenal product.
It has been fun. Yes. You've been a part of that, Michael.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. What I find for me, and I think this is what Relief Factor was intended to do, it's a dietary supplement. I take it whenever I, for instance, walk too far and feel aches or pains, and it actually does have an impact that, for me at least, registers within a couple of days. And that's fairly typical, isn't it, for most users?
Well, it can be. The bottom line, however, we recommend for real success, the best success, is that people take it every day. It's not designed like an aspirin. If you bang your thumb kind of a thing, you take a Relief Factor. No, that's not what it's designed for. It's basically designed to actually get into your system. Inflammation affects every cell in your body. And so these four ingredients were pulled together based upon the studies. Each ingredient deals with inflammation from a different metabolic pathway, but it actually is something designed to be taken every day. So we're quite excited with the results, especially when people take it every day.
Seth, in terms of those four ingredients, this is not like Jack's secret sauce. People can find out and know exactly what they're getting.
Oh, yes. It's all detailed. There's four key ingredients.
I know turmeric is one of them.
That's right. And icarin, resveratrol, and omega-3s.
One of the things that we run into that people incorrectly assume is that you can kind of buy these easily or cheaply from the local store.
Oh, yeah.
You mean the separate ingredients.
Yeah, because I watch user feedback both on social media and review sites, whatever. And one of the things that people get off there a little bit is that they think that they can take one or two and they're like, oh, well, it's just this product. And you can go and buy this for, you know, a few dollars at the store. And the problem is that a couple of these ingredients that work synergistically that really do contribute to helping your body fight inflammation are quite expensive to make. And one of the things that we found, and it's when customers have been with us for a long time, they do, of course, compare shop. And we do hear from customers that have been with us long term have said, I can't price this affordably outside. People who don't take it that look at it externally and they think that one or two in the ingredients, you know, well, this is really just what it is. Well, it actually is the combination. And people have tried. One of my favorite testimonials was from a woman who had tried to piecemeal it herself, and it didn't work for her, and she came back because it was too expensive trying to cobble it together on her own, which was, I thought, really interesting.
In fact, we've got a chiropractor who refers it to every patient now.
Yeah,
he says every single patient absolutely insists that they buy Relief Factor. And he says, I have to tell you, just last week he told me this. He says, I've been trying for over a year to duplicate what you have, to find all the different ingredients, and I can't come anywhere near it. So
not affordably.
It's not affordable.
Yeah, but you have the economies of scale, because right now Relief Factor is being sold all across the United States.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I mean, we have a strong base here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, we've sold over 1 million bags.
That's pretty incredible.
It's pretty. I never would have ever imagined that we would have. Honestly, I remember when we were first starting this years ago, and we were starting with you. You were absolutely one of the first we worked with. You know, we were thinking, oh, how exciting would that be to have a couple thousand subscribers to this? Cause, you know, but one of the big challenges, and I think we spoke about this when we first spoke, was how expensive it was to manufacture. Because these ingredients are only effective when people take them for a long period of time and in high dosage. That's the thing, is that it's high amounts of this. And that's one of the challenges that people find when they try to cobble it together, is that it's hard to get curcumin and resveratrol and icarin and omega in this purity and dosing. You can't cobble it together.
And one of the things that I've found with people, and again, I've given this to dozens of people now, and it's always been welcomed as a gift. And mm-hmm. But occasionally people saying, well, what am I doing wrong? And sometimes it'll be taking just one little plastic bag a day. You have to take three a day.
Yes, you should start. The idea is that you need to take quite a few packets a day until the pain goes away. That's one of the little shticks that we've been using internally to try to explain to people, because if people look at it like an Advil, where you take it once and then, okay, it's going to be great, or take it for a couple of days, you're actually giving the nutrients to your body to fight it on its own. That's one of the things that's this is why the approach is so different, is that we are helping your body fight inflammation. This isn't a product like a drug that fights inflammation on its own. We use that wording very carefully because we're trying to help your body do what it was made to do. And so that's why for a lot of people, you know, one of our favorite testimonies, the guy saw results in 4 days. For a lot of our customers, it takes a number of weeks at consistent dosing, multiple packets a day for a while, because you're trying to get your body to build up the resources it needs to go and attack what it knows is wrong. And it's very different. Different kinds of pain, different kinds of injury have different sort of timelines for when people finally see the corner. One of our favorite people we work with is Pat Boone, and his wife initially saw success within a few weeks, but then he called about 5 or 6 weeks later, and she had gone from having some pain reducing, which was very exciting for him, to it eliminated her pain. And there was a difference between that couple week result and the 5 to 6 week result. And once she got out of pain entirely, that completely changed their lives. That was such a big deal, and it still is to him. We were just with him recently, and he still talks about it, even though she just passed a couple of months ago.
And let me mention to people that you can find out all about Relief Factor by going to michaelmedved.com, clicking on the big banner that is proudly on our website, or you can call them toll-free at 833-654-PAIN. That's 833-654-PAIN. Pain. Some of the people I've given it to are in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And again, particularly if you do any kind of serious athletic exertion.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this can actually reduce the level of aches and pains and discomfort that you'll feel afterward.
Yeah. We actually had some friends over just the other night, and they had no idea what I do for a living. And they were describing how their teenage son is in high school football and coming home in excruciating pain all the time. We gave him a couple bags once I explained what I did for a living. And then my wife just called me yesterday or 2 days ago and said, you're going to need to get more bags because they are now begging. Because now the mom and the son take it because the mom has some back pain that she's lived with her whole life. And so now they're both completely hooked, and so she's
okay,
like,
you're
gonna have
you're
to
using
more bags.
Words here like we need to sell more bags and we need to bring more bags, and now they're completely hooked. I gotta make clear, there are no drugs.
That's right.
Relief Factor is entirely drug-free.
Entirely drug-free.
There are no medicines. This is nature at its best.
Yeah, you're helping your body fight inflammation. This is what your body's looking for. This is what we've been really blessed with, finding a combination that's been very, very effective of helping your own body. It's very different from using some sort of drug. There's a lot of things that drugs do that are radically different in how they approach trying to fight inflammation.
By the way, coming up to holiday season, it's a great gift.
Yeah.
And again, it doesn't imply that somebody is old and broken down.
No.
If you're giving Relief Factor as a gift, first of all, it comes in a handsome, it's kind of Seattle colors. It's kind of green
and
blue. You get
that. I'm glad you noticed that.
Yeah, it's Seahawks that. Colors.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Seahawks or Sounders, actually, both of them.
Correct. And by the way, members of the Seahawks and Sounders, I'm sure there are some who take Relief Factor.
I cannot comment on that.
Okay. No comment on that. But you can call up and find out all about Relief Factor, 833-654-PAIN, or go to our website and click on the big banner for Relief Factor. Pete and Seth Talbot, fathers and son, joint developers, inventors, creators of Relief Factor. Thanks for doing this.
Well,
and
thank you.
Thanks for making this product possible, and I'm very proud to be associated with it. And again, you can call at 833-654-PAIN. It's a great gift. In this greatest nation on God's green earth.